Eben Boots from Memorial University to be the seminar speaker today. Professor Boots, his main research interest is gravitational physics, especially numerical relativity. And today he's gonna talk about interesting signatures of, I guess, apparent horizons, I guess. Please take it away.
Thank you. So I think it's maybe a little bit of an exaggeration to say my main interest is in numerical relativity. I'm interested in numerical relativity, but all the numerics in this were, most of the numerics, pretty much all the numerics in this talk were done by Daniel Puchkolb. But that's okay. I am interested in numerics. So what I'll talk about today is exotic moths. I just lost the top. Let me see if I can get it on the top of my screen. Okay. Exotic moths and unexpected apparent horizons. So the motivation for this goes back to 50 years. So 50 years ago, I think we all know, we've all seen this pair of pants diagram. You're probably more familiar with the one that appears in Hawking and Ellis, but I managed to find one from a year before from the Lesueux lectures. And during a black hole merger, you have the two black holes approach each other. You think about the event horizons come together like the legs of a pair of pants. They kind of merge at the waist. And then you have the merged black hole at the end. And that's kind of been known since, I guess there must, I don't know whether there's something before this 1972 paper, but since at least for close to 50 years. But you can also see in this paper, people, they also understood then that there was something happening with the apparent horizons. So remember, the event horizons are sort of the last set of signals that don't get to infinity. And then the apparent horizons are these geometric objects, we'll talk about them a lot more, which have to do with their surfaces from which the light, well, I guess in this case, the boundary, this is how they were thinking at the time, they were boundary over the region of which contains trapped surfaces. So if you look down in this picture where you have the T1 and the T2, this was the two trapped regions at some slice in time. They continue to approach each other. And of course, the thing that people know has happens with apparent horizons, and they've known this since 50 years, the idea was at some point those things come close enough and then the horizon sort of jumps out and this new common horizon forms around them. Actually, I guess this is up here, the new apparent horizon. And then you have these two ones that remain on the inside, you have the outer one. And then you also have, and we've spent a lot of time looking at this picture and they don't really say much in the text, trying to figure out what they thought was happening here. They have an inner apparent horizon. And we think what they probably thought was that when the new one formed, there'd be some region of trapped surfaces around it. And then there'd be an inner boundary, which marked off the trapped surfaces. And so then they had like an outer apparent horizon and an inner apparent horizon. And then these things, the idea was then that probably this inner one would kind of merge in and then somehow it would merge with the two original ones. But, you know, as you can see, the diagram cuts off. So people didn't really know people didn't know what was happening there. And so what I'm gonna do in this talk is I'm gonna tell you what happened. So we pretty much know this now for the axisymmetric case. We expect this will continue to the non-axisymmetric case, but something similar happened, but that bit hasn't been done yet. So this is work that I did with Roby Henniger, who was a postdoc here at Memorial. I'm just gonna move this over the screen. Who was a postdoc here with me at Memorial at the time. And Daniel Puchkolb, who was just finishing his PhD. He just finished his PhD at the Max Planck Institute in Hanover, last fall, I guess. And so as it turns out, actually, I was an examiner for his thesis, and while reading his thesis, who I kind of had the idea of what to do here, contacted him afterwards and we did this work. So Daniel is the man who did all the numerics here. And then Roby and I sort of came in with some of the more analytical ideas. But it's also connected to a paper that Roby and I wrote the year before with my master's student, Shoikot Mondal. Which looked at the case for Schwarzschild, and then there's some ideas coming from some upcoming papers we have on this. And most of this complication down in the right-hand corner has to do with Roby, who has switched institutions a couple times and was also supported by a Banting Fellowship at the time. So I think three of the four things down there are to do with Roby. Okay, so let's go on now. Whoops. Okay, so what we would like to know is, what we all like to know is what is the full apparent horizon pair of pants diagram? What is a typically marginally out of trap surface look like? And are there any physical implications for all of this? Sorry, I'm trying to get this off my screen. Oh, there we go. Okay. And are these, yeah, so that's what we're going to talk about. Okay, so first we have to review apparent horizons. So an emerging out of trap surface, the picture probably most of you guys know this, but you think about, you have a two-dimensional surface sitting in space, which is represented by that circle there. You imagine a bunch of light bulbs on the surface of that two surface, you flash the light bulbs, and then light moves out from the surface, right? So if you did that in, you know, a room like you're sitting in right now, that light sphere would get bigger as it moved outwards. So that's kind of what we show here. The area expands. If you did it and you have something called a trap surface, then even though you try to shoot the light outwards, the gravity is strong enough that the light comes back in and you have a trap surface. And if you had everything balanced just perfectly so that the light rays stayed the same area as they moved outwards, then it's a marginally out of trap surface. And one of the results that was proved back in the early 70s, or maybe even the late 60s, I'm not quite sure, was that apparent horizons are examples of a MOT. So if you like, the intuition there would be, the intuition isn't quite right, but the intuition would be, you find all the trapped surfaces, you take the union, well, you take the union of all the trapped surfaces, this is what you do, you take the boundary of that, and if you think, well, they're all trapped, then maybe the boundary will be marginally out of trapped. And that is essentially the case. Okay. So let's think about the simplest case. So the simplest case that we all know about, and in some sense, I think we kind of, many of it, we often just sort of think is all there is a Schwarzschild black hole. So for a Schwarzschild black hole, we have anything, here I'm looking at any Finkelstein coordinates falling in, but it doesn't matter so much. And then at the black hole horizon, R equals 2m, it's the event horizon in this case, because they all coincide in a static space time. Then the outward expansion, which I'm going to call theta L, is equal to zero. So that's emerging out of trapped surface. And by contrast, if you're outside, then of course, the light rays will go out and theta L will be positive. The expansion will be positive, the outward null expansion. And if you're inwards, then the area will get smaller. So theta L would be less than zero. And so those are sort of like the situations, the three kind of standard situations. And I think when we learn this, we kind of all think, or at least I did until quite recently, that once that, you know, that's basically it. That's all we have, right? We have, you know, we have this one with where it's zero, we have stuff inside, we have stuff outside. If we went to like a De Sitter space-time, then we'd have another one outside, it rises to Nordstrom, we'd have another margin of our trapped surface inside, but we think that maybe that's all there is. But what we're gonna see is that's not nearly all there is. Okay, so, but if we're thinking about the dynamics, I'll talk about how people have thought about it for maybe the last 20 or 25 years. So this is just, you can ignore most of the stuff on this slide. This is what I'm just saying here. This is a Lemaître-Tolman-Bondi, which is an exact solution. So this is, you have some distribution of time like dust. So if you think of like on the bottom here, you have the radius versus density roughly, right? So this is a bunch of different situations, kind of like, you know, a steep drop off, a less steep drop off, kind of a smooth distribution, right? That's dust sort of going out and getting less dense. And then you can evolve it forward in time and you can do that exactly. And then this is the time evolution of the marginally out of trapped surface. So we have, I guess we have time running along here and this is area here, right? So the area kind of expands in time. Though in some cases, the area sort of goes backwards. The area sort of gets smaller here and we'll talk about that. And then there's the signature there. So this was an exact solution that I did with Lionel Britz, Jose Gonzalez and Chris Vandenbrock back in like 15 years ago now, I guess. But it was preceded by a year or two by a kind of equivalent, well, not quite equivalent, a similar calculation of putting together FLRW and Schwarzschild by Ishai Ben-Dov. And so let's just look at the picture. Oops, okay, and this is a more complicated situation. So the picture there is though, so you think in this picture here, we have radius increasing outwards, time going up. You think about your time equals constant slices, right? Like TA, TB, TC, TD, TE. You imagine your matter is falling into this. And so at TA, you just have the horizon. So you think about a spherical horizon expanding here now. At TB, the mass, enough mass has come inside this region here that you form a common, a new horizon outside of the original one. So somehow you, you know, intuitively you increase the density of that region sufficiently to create a new black hole. And that's the picture of the common horizon that we saw in the that diagram from Hawking. Now, what's been known since then though, is that you have the, and if you just think about spherically symmetric surfaces, then all the gray ones in here are trapped and all the white ones are untrapped. And then the black line is the merging out of trapped. And so what you can think of is that you have, if you think about, you know, the Hawking picture there, you have this new horizon form, you have that trapped region, like in the Hawking picture, kind of gradually moves inwards. This trapped region moves outwards as, you know, more stuff falls in, and eventually they merge. Another way you can think about that, if you just thought about the horizons evolving themselves, you could think of this as kind of like a pair creation event, an inner and outer horizon form. The outward one moves outwards, the inward one moves inwards, and then ultimately that inward moving horizon meets the original horizon and annihilates. And then later on, everything returns to equilibrium. So that is kind of the intuitive picture that we all had for many years. And we thought that something similar was going to be happening in, okay, and I said, or you could, or I guess, sorry, I should say, well, the other way you could think of that is you could think of this as an original, as a single horizon that moves, it evolves at some point with, you get enough mass in there, somehow it turns around, goes backwards in time. That's like the, that's where it's shrinking, like we saw in that previous diagram. And then it turns, at another point, it turns around and starts increasing again. So you have a, this is what you might, if those of you guys who know about, you know, the dynamical horizons, you'd have dynamical horizons here and here, and this would be a time-like membrane in between. Okay, so that's the picture. So you can think of it either as this thing weaving backwards and forwards through time, or you can do these kind of creation and annihilation events. Or you could, I guess you could think of the expansion of the trapped region. Now, that's great if you're just thinking about spherical symmetry, but if you allow for non-spherically symmetric surfaces, it turns out that you can actually get, it's known now that you can actually get trapped surfaces going into this region here. So this is kind of an incomplete picture. Okay, so still got this on the, I'm just gonna, oh, there we go, okay. Okay, so now, so the idea was maybe there'd be a pair of pants for the apparent horizon as well. And so this was the kind of what people thought up to, I guess, at least 2018, I think. Yeah, you know, I guess other people may have had other ideas, but everyone I knew thought this up to 2018. And this goes back at least to Hayward. That's the earliest paper I find mentioned talking about that continuous horizon weaving through time. I think it went back further than that because I was sort of in the field then. And I think I remember discussions before that, but I don't have any published paper result. But anyway, so the idea was maybe you have a more complicated apparent pair of pants for the apparent horizons. So here we see, this is the idea, this is from 2018, a paper by Gupta, Krishnan, Nielsen, and Schnetter. And the idea was, you know, you'd have during the merger, you have those two black holes coming in, they're kind of orbiting each other. You have at this point, the common horizon forms, you have that inner horizon at the same time, the outer horizon comes out, the inner horizon comes in, and then somehow it would annihilate here. I mean, this is certainly what I believe was going to happen as well back then. But this picture couldn't be resolved, and this picture hadn't been actually observed because the apparent horizon finders could not figure out what was happening in this region. And there's two problems happening there. The first problem is that as you're getting closer there, you're getting closer to the punctures, you have the time slowing down as you approach those punctures, you're losing numerical resolution, and so the apparent horizon finders aren't working well in that region. And then additionally, time is slowing down, so you may not even see the final stage. But then the other complication that happens there is that, well, I'll talk about that on the next page. The apparent horizon finders were assuming there was a particular geometry. And I guess just over here, I'll show this is in 2015. And so this was, if you have those two apparent horizons approaching each other here, I think this may have been the first time that people started to resolve them starting to interpenetrate each other. So that would be kind of like around this region here. I might be wrong on that, but I think this may have been. So this was, you know, this was a kind of a new result at the time. And then this, but it seemed consistent with this picture here. But like I said, the apparent horizon finders lost track of the horizons. Okay, oops. Okay, so let's think about the Mott's finder. So the ones that I'm telling you about that lost track of it, the way they worked is the following. They assumed what we'll say is a star-shaped region. So they have some initial point, you know, sort of the origin of the coordinates, and then you get a different coordinate systems, but you can think about, you can shoot rays out in the coordinate system and they'll go out to the horizon. You can solve a second order elliptic PDE to find one of these emerging Earth trap surfaces in that case. But of course, if you assume that you're looking at as R as a function of theta and phi in that case, then you're assuming this region is star shaped. So for example, if there's a bit here where you can't get a ray directly from the origin into it, then this cannot be found by a horizon finder like this. Or similarly, if you have some kind of self-intersecting region, then this stuff could not be found by an apparent horizon finder. So the innovation, so it can only identify star-shaped margin error trap surfaces. The innovation from this 2019 paper by Daniel Bernholtz, Christian, and Schneider was that instead of measuring out from the origin, you take some reference surface, and then you measure. So I think my reference surface here is kind of the blue one, maybe. And then you look for surfaces near that surface. You kind of measure distances off that surface as you go around. Take the normal to that surface. There's the normal to the surface. You have some function measuring the distance along that normal, and you look for a surface that way. And well, we're going to see what happens now. So this is a significant improvement in finding more dramatic surfaces, but you still need, but you still need to have a guess for the initial surface, right? So you still need that initial surface. Now, what happens once you're doing a time evolution is you would use the surface from the previous step to find the one in the next step, and you'd run it like that. So this is a paper from 2019 this is the same paper that I was talking about where they introduced this method. And they were looking for emerging R trap surface. This was just in Berlinguist initial data. This was kind of the picture that's known. This is Berlinguist data, right? So this is instantaneously static. Yeah, so you have the smaller black hole, the larger black hole. This is the common inner horizon. This is the common outer horizon. And then you have a parameter. This is an exact solution, so you can move it closer and closer and look what things look like. And what they found was that as you move this closer and closer and closer, this neck pinched together more and more and more until it almost pinched off at that stage there. Now, this is initial data, though, right? So this isn't a dynamic evolution here. But this is initial data. But this has already now found a surface that couldn't have been found by the previous finders because it's now gone beyond star shape. So that was 2018. And then in 2019, there was a more dramatic result because you look at this and you say, well, it's initial data, it's time symmetric, it's very spatial initial data. This could be just some very special thing with the initial data. Plus, these are weird space times because they have never actually formed, right? This is a moment of the moment of stationarity, right? So like, you never actually had two black holes separate here. You had, coming in from the white hole past, so they come up here, they move out, and then they move back together, and they never actually separate. So there's a lot of things that could be funny in this data. But it turns out that not dramatically. So then in 2019, same authors, they started from initial data, but they started with the black holes sufficiently far apart that they didn't have a common horizon, let them go. And as they're moving in, this is kind of like, the standard picture. You've got your outer horizon form, your inner horizon, your two initial ones. But then now using this new horizon finder, the green one, inner horizon continues to hug tighter and tighter on the two original ones until we get to this region. And I guess this isn't the next step, but slightly after that, there was this, very unexpected event where the outer horizon crossed itself, or the inner horizon crossed itself. So this is all, of course, inside the outer horizon. So this is internal black hole dynamics we're talking about here. But this is dynamic evolution, and we see these self-intersecting surfaces. And from what Daniel tells me, the idea to look for possible self-intersecting surfaces came from Eric. But anyway, so this is kind of a new, kind of exciting thing. And you start to think, okay, well, we've got these self-intersecting surfaces. What might happen next? Okay. But what that pointed out there is that that surface, finding that self-intersection was dependent on not thinking to look for that self-intersection. So there could be a lot of stuff happening that even with this new improved finder, you might not know was there because you didn't think to look for it. And so what we need here is an agnostic Mach finder where you don't have to assume the geometry. And what we're going to do to talk about that one is we're actually just going to go back to basically the parent horizon finders that people used 50 years ago. And this surface and this thing in the background, we'll see this a couple more times. I call it the evil alien picture because I think it kind of looks kind of sinister there in the eyes here. And it's holding some kind of crystal ball or something in its kind of mitten hands. Okay. As you might guess, those in fact are all merging outer trap surfaces appearing during a merger, but we'll come back to that. So what we're going to look now is we're going to look for axisymmetric merging outer trapped, and I put an O there, MOTOS, for open surfaces. So remember, merging outer trapped surface, you normally assume that the outward expansion is zero and the surface is closed. Okay. It turns out to make progress and understand the more general thing, it's useful to start thinking about surfaces that might be merging outer trapped but open. So they don't close. They're merging outer trapped everywhere, but maybe they go on out to infinity, which we'll see. And so the picture is, so actually this, the method I'm going to describe here doesn't appear in this paper, the paper with Schoikot. It's in fact improved. We had a very difficult method to use back in that paper. We implemented it, but it involved doing like piecing together 15, 20, sometimes 30 integrations of different types. Then in this improved method in the paper with Roby and Daniel, we got to a situation where you can just, is much easier. This was like painful, required human intervention. This is trivial numerical integrations. But here's the picture, what we do. Is you imagine you got your space-time slice because we're thinking numerics, right? We're going to start with the foliation of space-time. It's got a future time like normal UA. We think about a surface in that slice, and we're only in axisymmetry. This will only work for an axisymmetry for now. You have the normal to the surface, and then you can talk about the space-like expansion of the surface, which is the metric of the surface contracted with the extrinsic curvature. That's like the trace of the extrinsic curvature in the time-like direction. And the space-like expansion, which is the trace of the extrinsic curvature in the space-like direction. And if we add them together, then we get the outward null expansion. And what one wants to do then is wants to solve those equations. And to solve those equations, that is a second order PDE. So if I just kind of wrote it out with Christoffel symbols in the surface, what we're saying is that this derivative of the normal vector is, you know, Christoffel symbols plus the extrinsic curvature. Now that normal vector in itself is, if you think about it as a surface being specified, that normal vector involves derivatives of the surface. And that's why this is a second order PDE. Okay. But what we're going to do is we're going to rewrite this. And this is the kind of equation I was talking about that was being solved by this other finders. But because we're in axisymmetry, what we can do is we can rewrite it in a different way. And to rewrite it in a different way, we are going to look at, we're going to look at what we ended up calling Matsudaisy, because we resisted calling them this, but we ended up doing it. So take a slice of that surface, and instead of thinking about the surface itself, think about a curve in the plane that, when rotated, generates the surface. And in this case, I'm in quasi cylindrical coordinate. Well, I'm in cylindrical coordinates, in fact, in this case. So if you do that, then you can, the trace of the extrinsic curve in the space-like direction, remember it's the two metric, and this is the two metric with respect to like sort of a orthonormal dyad, right? So this is just the Q times dn. And then, but of course, tt times dn, you can t and n, t is the tangent, n is the normal. You can kind of, you know, commute those with the negative sign. And then you get the acceleration in this plane, okay? And then the other term, we just leave it. And then the Ku also gets a term, but then if Kn plus Ku is equal to zero, we'll have this term, which is like an acceleration, is equal to, you know, these terms here, which give you the acceleration. So we do that. And so we rewrite the Mott's equation, the margin outer trap surface equation, in something that looks like the geodesic equation. So if kappa was equal to zero, this would of course just be the geodesic equation, which is why we call it the Matsudaisics. But now that kappa is determined by how everything's embedded. And so this is very similar to the method that was used by back in at least 74, maybe even before that, for finding margin outer trap surfaces in, or for finding, I guess they just call them apparent horizons then, in the Brill-Lindquist data. It was Brill-Lindquist data, I think, in this paper. But it hasn't done exactly this way before. And this is a method that you can use in any non-rotating axisymmetric space-time. We can fix this so you can use in rotating ones as well, but that's not in these papers. We've learned that since. Okay, but if you look at this, the thing to think about here is now this is just a second order ODE, right? And of course, so, you know, with a second order ODE, this is a pair of coupled second order ODEs. So we know, of course, that if we have any initial conditions, then we can evolve and get a solution, right? The solutions usually won't be closed, but of course, just like you shoot geodesics off in any direction, you could shoot these matsudesics off in any direction. So let's just think of the simplest example. So if you're doing this in Schwarzschild, and we do it in Pavlovian-Goldstein coordinates because we want, they're very nice coordinates to work with in this case because they've got horizon penetrating slices and those slices are space-like and in fact they're Euclidean. So this is a very convenient one to work in. So in that case, the differential equations for finding the MOTS in this case is reduced to these. And these are like trivial to solve if you're using Maple or Mathematica or any mathematical thing you like. You just, you know, put them in, ask it to solve it, give it initial conditions, and it gives you, on my six-year-old laptop, I can solve these basically instantly for anything I want. Okay, so these are very easy to solve. It's very easy to study. So I think really the main difference, so what we're talking about here could have actually really been done with the methods back in the 70s. But I think probably they're, well, I guess maybe they were constrained by how much they could explore by computers back 50 years ago. But there's nothing dramatic happening here. These are simple equations to solve. Okay, so now here we are in Schwarzschild. And so what we're going to do here is R equals 2m, of course, is the margin on a trapped surface. So you can think about shooting things just outside and just inside. And if you shoot them just outside, they'll tend to come round. They don't like, because this is axis symmetry, they're forced not to intersect the axis. They don't like intersecting the axis, so the axis effectively repels them. If you look at the equations, you can kind of see this kind of repulsion term coming away from the axis. This is, if you think about it, you can think about the simple case where you would be just looking at a minimal surface, right? So if the extrinsic curvature of the big K was zero, then the margin out trapped surfaces in that case are minimal surfaces. And you may remember that minimal surfaces in Euclidean are three axisymmetric, the catenoids or the rotated catenoids. So that's the same thing we have here, same kind of thing here. But if you are on the inside, you can see that instead of turning around to go back, well, you still turn around, but you flip over and you get a self-intersection. And then you go a little further in, you flip over, you get a self-intersection. You flip over, get a self-intersection. You flip over, get another self-intersection. As you can see, at the same time, these outer ones are starting to kind of move in. And if you continue, so it's just a zoom in of them turning around. We'll skip that though. Okay, but if you can keep on doing that, then in fact, they continue to fold in. And then at some point, you get a surface that just closes up. And that is a margin out of trap surface. And you can keep on doing it. You can get more and more of these folds. And so in fact, this is the paper with Schreikop, me and Robin Schreikop. You see that in this case, R equals 2M is in fact the first of a family of margin out of trap surfaces with increasing numbers of self-intersections. So one, two, well, I usually just think of half of the diagram. So it's one, two, but you can think two, four, and goes on like this. And we have no reason to think that this isn't infinite, right? I mean, whenever we kept looking, we could keep finding more and more and more. So this is in Schwarzschild. And you might think, well, this is kind of weird. We've gone off, what are all these things? We'll talk more about what their significance is later. But if you think about those self-intersections, right? Remember, we saw self-intersections similar to this back in the dynamics paper. Okay, so how generic are these? You might think, well, okay, they use a weird coordinate system. If you think of Pavlovian-Goldstein as weird, I would argue it's actually more generic than like Borel-Lindquist coordinates, but you could say, well, what about these coordinate systems? Is this, you know, you got all the symmetry, is this all very special? And the answer is these seem to be completely generic. So in some work that I've done since with some of my master's students and Roby and Harry Kanduri, we've since seen similar things, not exactly the same, but very similar things in almost any Schwarzschild coordinate system you think of, in Reisner-Nordström. We've got it in Kerr now, Gauss-Bonnet, loop quantum gravity, inspired gravity, five-dimension Schwarzschild and Myers-Perry. They all include these features. They all have these sets of margin out of trap surfaces. They're not always infinite, in fact, but they have these sets of margin out of trap surfaces inside that I guess we just didn't know about before because no one looked for them, I guess. Okay, so should we be surprised by this result? Well, I was certainly surprised at the time, but if you think about it, maybe it's not really so surprising. Okay, so let's just go back to the simplest case you might think of. So you could think about a 2 plus 1 dimensional space-time I'm not going to demand this Einstein equation. I just want something very simple with two-dimensional spatial slices. And then a surface in that is just a one-dimensional curve, right? And we're going to say the extrinsic curvature of that two-dimensional slice in three-dimensional space-time is zero. Then, as I said before, the Mott's equation reduces basically to the geodesic, well, it reduces to this, which is the geodesic equation, because Q is a one-dimensional metric here, which is just the tangent vector, the unit tangent vector contracted twice. And you can rewrite it, and then we actually have the geodesic equations. So if we have a Riemannian two surface with, you know, embedded flatly, in some sense, in a bit larger space, and these will be the margin or trap surface, the minimal surfaces. Okay, so let's think about this. So here's a sample surface. So I think we can all look at this and spot a bunch of closed, because we want to think about closed surfaces. We all know there's closed ones at the waist and at the bulgy parts, right? You do this in any kind of first Riemannian geometry class. But of course, these are just the geodesic equations. So I could fire these off in different angles, and it's not a shock then that I get more geodesics. These would be merging our trap open surfaces because they aren't closed though. But you can imagine, you know, there's a lot of options here. And so you can imagine, in fact, there are also some closed surfaces beyond the obvious ones. So, you know, maybe it's not so surprising we find them in Schwarzschild in that case. All right, so there's these closed surfaces. Okay, so now let's go back and think about more interesting things than Schwarzschild. So go back to that Brill-Lindquist data. So the Brill-Lindquist data, again, this is, you know, the instantaneously stationary. So again, the margin hour trap surfaces are just minimal surfaces here now, Riemannian minimal surfaces, and we're still in axisymmetry, of course. So we have a situation where you kind of like an outer horizon, an inner horizon, and the two, you know, the smaller black hole and larger black hole. Okay, so we apply the same methods. What we did is we just marched down the z-axis, firing things off at right angles to see what would happen. Oh, okay, here are the equations. As you can see, again, these equations are simple, right? They're, you know, they're second order equations. You can integrate them trivially with any way you like. Okay, so we're gonna start off with this, thinking about the Schwarzschild case. So in the Schwarzschild case, I'm going to start marching down the axis here. So in this is in Brill-Lindquist coordinates. So the horizon's at 1/2 rather than 2 here, just because of the way things are. So I start marching down the surface. And so as I start to approach half, you see that kind of starts to fold in, folds in a bit more, comes in, gets repelled by the z-axis, heads back out. But as you get closer and closer, it kind of starts to come around again, turns around again, turns around again, turns around again. Now, none of these actually close, but what you can see here is there's, for minimal surfaces and in the extended margin out of trap surfaces, there are uniqueness theorems that say that if your surfaces are touching each other and they have a common normal vector, which is pointing in the same direction, then they are the same surface. So you can always think this is like as the onset of the uniqueness theorem. As you get closer and closer, you want to stay closer. You want to stay closer and closer to it. We saw these results earlier on when we were looking at this stuff, and then we later discovered that Hubany and some collaborators had seen the similar things in ADS in the context of some holographic studies. Okay, but this is just Schwarzschild. So we don't seem to have any new closed surfaces in this particular coordinate system, this time symmetric data. But if you look in general Brill-Lindquist data, where we have sort of two point sources, then as you can see that, yes, we do have more now. And so if you look at this guy here, for example, it comes around the big black hole, we'll say, comes down, turns around, repelled from the axis, comes back over, ultimately closes. So this is a margin hour trap surface that encloses one of the punctures, but not the other one. This is the converse, it encloses like the big puncture, if I can use those words, but not the little one. Here is a margin hour trap surface that encloses neither of the punctures, right? So these punctures are not contained in this surface. I mean, they're contained in other surfaces. And then you can keep on going as you get closer and more, you can get more and more folds going back and forth like you saw in Schwarzschild. Okay, so as far as we can tell, there's an infinite family of these kinds of things as well. You might look at this and think, well, they're kind of hugging the surfaces. What's all that about? We're going to come back to that. Okay, so in Brill-Lindquist, there is likely beyond these ones, there is likely an infinite number here as well, which, you know, variously wrap around and don't wrap around the punctures. Okay, so again, you might say, okay, well, maybe this is just crazy initial data, right? What happens if we evolve this data? And in particular, again, it's Brill-Lindquist. So at no point did those spacetimes ever have two separate horizons, two separate black holes. So this is the stuff that we started doing with that, where Daniel started, ran the codes, and we kind of, basically at this stage, from, I'll explain this now, but basically at this stage, we understood there were probably these more exotic surfaces. So we had some ideas from the Brill-Lindquist and from the Schwarzschild to look for, and then he used the, you know, his improved finder, right? So we weren't, though we did actually do all of the, a lot of these both ways, both with the Matsudaisic equations and with his improved finder equations to confirm. So we have two independent calculations of these surfaces, identifying them. But a lot of this was then done by his methods. Okay, so let's just think about what's happening here. So, okay, this figure on the left, what you see is time is running across the bottom and the area of emerging artifact surface is shown on top. And so in the paper I talked about from 2019, the Pukult, Bernholtz, Christian, and Schnettery evolution, we saw, and then on the right-hand side, you can see the horizons approach, they interpenetrate, and then this was the point where they lost it, okay? Now, what happens at that point, though? In fact, that is actually the point where the that horizon is sort of is annihilated. The horizon actually disappears at that point. But why does it disappear? Well, it disappears because another emerging artifact surface, and you notice this is one that is only circling one of the punctures, came forward and met it and annihilated it, kind of like you might have expected from those spherically symmetric ones, but of course they're more complicated. And then there was no horizon, there was no sort of like outer horizon beyond that point, right? So this is the death of the larger horizon, right? You can't, don't take the sizes of things too literally on the right, because it's, you know, it's just coordinates, right? And so then you might say, okay, well, that's interesting, but where did that thing come from? Well, that thing in fact came from this event here, which it didn't exist before that. It sort of pair created at that point with this thing that then went in, and it fades out here because we lost numerical resolution. But, you know, we had a pair creation event of two things, and then they met up here, and that was the death of the larger initial horizon. We have good numerical evidence that this also happens with a small numerical horizon. Well, me and Roby are completely convinced. Daniel's a bit more cautious. If anyone knows Daniel, they know he's more cautious. But we're convinced that the same thing happens with the smaller one as well. We actually have simulations that basically show it, but the resolution isn't great at that stage, and there's some weird things, but it almost certainly, like 99% it also happens with a smaller one. Okay, so what else happened though? Whoops. Okay, so here's some pictures of like time steps there. I think we've talked about this one. Okay, so now what about what's happening in this situation? So you can also think about the inner and the outer horizon. So you've got that common horizon and what you might think of as the inner horizon. Okay, so this one's a more complicated one. But I'll talk it through now once the movie finishes the first time. Okay, so let's look at this now. So this is the original outer horizon moving outwards into, you know, after the merger. Okay, and so it's been known now since basically probably since the 70s that you would get this inner and outer horizon forming together, right? So this is what was known about. This is the inner horizon coming in. And this is the same event. This is where the outer and the inner touch is actually something interesting. The original two touch, something one can say there, but I won't for now. And then this is the end of the evolution of the Pukult, Bernholtz, Christian, Schnetter evolution, okay, where you see that self-intersection. And they lost it at that point because, in fact, it was met by another surface that came in, met it, and at this point, there was annihilation. So that's why it disappeared. It didn't exist after that point. It met an annihilation. And that more complicated surface was from this event where, you know, there's a pair creation there with the one that was going to annihilate the inner horizon and this event here, which ultimately came in. And you can't see so well here, but it is true. There are now two sets of self-intersections there, or four, depending how you want to count it. And then again, this is getting close to the puncture, and so numerical resolution was lost at this stage. Okay. And then there's a picture of some of the steps there, but again, we kind of looked at the movie already. Okay, so Daniel also did a kind of a nice kind of 3D plot of this. I think he said this one took 40 hours to run. So there you have that sort of like the outer horizon sort of coming back in time. Kind of the, you have that pair creation event. So you can think of those two things going forward. That's the annihilation event. So now you can think of the two coming up to meet at that stage. And in turn, there was a pair creation happening there. And again, we're confident that this kind of thing keeps on going. But we don't have, again, we lost the numerical resolution. And so I kind of think of this as the parent horizon ball gown rather than a pair of pants, because you got these kind of folds back and forth. Okay, but those aren't the only ones. In fact, there's more. So here is all the ones we found, but of course we think there's way more than this. And you know, they're in a variety of colors, so you got all kinds of things appearing and disappearing. And again, where they fade out, that's where we lost them numerically. Rather than them just actually disappearing at that stage. And you can see these kinds of things merging. You can see things kind of coming together there and starting to merge in pairs. See, there's annihilation, and then kind of things fade out there with the numerics. I'm not going to talk too much about this, but if you go back here, you can see that in fact, before the common horizon formed, right, which is at that stage, there was some action happening inside. And what we've seen now, we've seen this in other, we can actually see this in crucible coordinates. This is as you go from time symmetry into non-time symmetry, you actually get extra margin out of trap surfaces that straddle the wormhole going into the other universe. They're not a primary focus here, but I'll just mention them as to give you an idea of the kinds of things that are happening. But these are all, you know, these are all margin out of trap surfaces found by two different methods. Okay, so the question is, so you notice I wasn't calling them all apparent horizons, but you might think, well, are these all apparent horizons? Or are these all somehow boundaries between trapped and untrapped regions? And like, or is this just chaos, right? Does this mean there's no point ever looking for an apparent horizon because it's, you just got mass chaos? Do they separate trapped, untrapped regions? And in order to understand this, we're going to turn to something called the stability operator. And this is something that's, again, comes out of differential geometry. So just think about, go back to our geodesic example. So if you remember geodesics, if you might remember the Jacobi operator, when you take second variations of a geodesic, right, you can have ones that are stable or unstable. And in a stable one corresponds to like kind of an actual minimal length one. So this would be like, of course, all geodesics in Euclidean geometry are minimal length. But if you remember your stuff on the surface of a sphere, once you go beyond a certain point from the origin, they're no longer stable and there's, and stability fails. It's kind of like the second derivative of the length of these things. So we have a stable one at a minimum and we have unstables at the max. And so in fact, if you fired like, you know, nearby geodesics to the stable ones, what happens is they kind of move away from it. They're kind of like repelled by the stable ones. And if you, that's, well, you might think, well, think, just think back to the Schwarzschild example. The outer horizon there was stable. We'll see that again now. And the unstable ones, though, you tend to get oscillations around the unstable ones. Because remember, there's going to be conjugate points in those cases. So I think that's what we hear. So if you think about the second variation of the length, then we can write it in terms of the Jacobi operator, which is this, right, in this case. And then you can, it's an operator, so you can take the eigenvalue spectrum of that operator, and it turns out that the stable ones correspond to all of the eigenvalues being positive. And so you think about this as a second order of the length. So if all the eigenfunctions have positive eigenvalues and they form a basis for the possible deformations, then every element of that basis as you add it in is going to cause an increase in length, right? So that's kind of why you have stability with all the eigenvalues are positive. But you might also have some negative ones. And these are the ones that are unstable. So if you have one or more negative eigenvalues, the corresponding eigenfunctions, if you evolved along them, then if you kind of deformed in that direction, the area will get smaller. And so that's where you have the unstable ones, right? This is the case here. And you know, that's like you're at the fattest part. So obviously there's going to be some directions that are going to make where you could deform to make things smaller. So that's for geodesics. Now, in fact, the stability operator also exists for MOTS. Here, I'm just going to talk about axisymmetry. And this was actually introduced for a slightly different reason back in 2005 by Anderson, Mars, and Simon. And what they wanted to know then was if you have a merging out of trap surface in one surface of a foliation and you're running a time evolution, will there be one in the next slice? And the stability operator turns out that if you're stable, which is that you have no negative eigenvalues, then, if none of the eigenvalues vanish, then it turns out you can always evolve to the next step. But if it is, if all the eigenvalues are positive, then in that case, then do you have the additional property that you separate trapped from untrapped regions. So that's kind of what you want an apparent horizon to do. So if it's stable, if you remember those diagrams I had, well, we'll see pictures of it. But basically, the surf things don't like crossing the trap ones. You can get some cross it, but they don't like crossing the stable ones. If they're unstable, though, you have, if they're unstable, you actually have conjugate points. And this is, I guess, for some reason, people didn't really think about there were conjugate points associated with these stability operators like Jacobi things before. But anyway, it is true. And so the apparent horizon, you think of a black hole boundary as being when you have stability. And if you're unstable, then you wouldn't really think of it as an apparent horizon because in particular, it doesn't actually even separate trapped from untrapped regions. So now let's look at our examples. Okay. Okay, so think about in Schwarzschild. So if you had the Schwarzschild space-time, this, the stability operator takes this form. We don't really want to go into why, but it just reduces from the previous page. And then the eigenfunction of spherical harmonics, the eigenvalue spectrum is 1 over the horizon radius plus L times L plus 1. The M's don't show up. And so clearly, all the eigenvalues here are going to be positive. So what we, so the outer horizon of Schwarzschild should be stable. And you can see that happening here, similar to that diagram I had before. You can't see here, I started out a bunch of margin arbitrary Matsudaisics close in to R equals 2m. And as they came round, they kind of gradually moved away. And that's what you expect from a stable. Now think about if you look at a Riesen-Nordström black hole. So for Riesen-Nordström, the stability operator takes this form. And the eigenfunctions are still spherical harmonics, but the eigenvalues are this is like the form you had in Schwarzschild, but you also have this minus q squared. So it turns out when you do this for the outer horizon, this is stable. But if you look at the inner horizon, you can get unstable inner horizons. Well, the inner horizons are unstable in for Riesen-Nordström in this sense. And so they will always have one or more negative eigenvalues. Now, if you think about that in terms of like negative eigenvalues, you should think kind of like conjugate points for geodesics. And in fact, that's what we see here. So if the smallest eigenvalue vanishes, then that actually corresponds to an extremal black hole where you wouldn't expect any conjugate points because you've got no negative eigenvalues. If you have one negative eigenvalue, so this is as Q starts decreasing, you get one conjugate point in the way you'd expect, one negative eigenvalue, one conjugate point, or one non-degenerate. This is just if setting M equals zero, I guess. If you have two negative eigenvalues, you get two intersections, three negative eigenvalues, you get three intersections, and so on. So the stability operator was introduced to talk about evolutions. Actually, this is a very nice way of understanding it geometrically because it also tells you about what nearby surfaces are doing. Okay, so let's think about all these crazy surfaces we saw in Schwarzschild. Well, it turns R equals 2m is stable, we know that. The rest of them are all unstable. And in fact, they have, depending whether you count this as one or two self-intersections, depending on what you're thinking about with the rotation, they have either the same number of negative eigenvalues of the self-intersections. Probably you want to think of this as one, because of course this thing should be rotated, right? You have a ring you have one ring of self-intersections, two ring of self-intersections, three rings of self-intersections, and it turns out there's twice as many negative eigenvalues. So those are all unstable, okay? And for the case where there's four negative eigenvalues, we see what we now expect. We see those four kind of self-intersections with the kind of the nearby surfaces. Okay, now let's go back to this.
Can I interrupt you just for a sec?
Sure.
So I'm trying to understand the previous plot.
Yeah.
So so the eigenvalues are governed by L, which is your angular Laplacian eigenvalue.
Yeah.
So how do I see L in those surfaces? Is it the labeling of all those surfaces that you see here? So I'm not seeing the connection.
Oh, yeah, well, I guess it's not obvious, right? Okay, so what happens is in fact, Daniel sat down and he just calculated the eigenvalue spectrum for each of these surfaces, sat down and calculated it numerically. So he, you know, he took a basis, he expanded it, he kind of found the eigenvalues of, you know, a matrix, and this is where the negative ones are. But so that is kind of a non-obvious calculation. But what I was trying to show in this one is that you can also, on if you're trying to think about it kind of geometrically, it also corresponds to, like, just like conjugate points sort of tell you the number, what, like, nearby geodesics self-intersect at the conjugate points. In this case, when we had four negative eigenvalues, we had these four self-intersections of the nearby surfaces.
Okay, that's a way of doing it. So but what's the connection with L? So where do you see L there?
Oh, right, okay, yeah. So I guess L is just, okay, so in these cases, okay, that worked for spherical symmetry, but in these cases, you just calculate the number of negative eigenvalues. And maybe I said that was L equals 2 or something like that, but it's just essentially, when you have that number of negative eigenvalues, you just assign the L to it.
Yeah,
you just say, it's just the same way.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, I might have said that in a confusing way. Okay, so then if you look at during the merger here, so this is just a selection of them. So what's happening there? So it turns out that during the merger, each time the horizon sort of like turns around in time, that corresponds to a negative eigenvalue showing up. So if you look at the original, If you look at the original surface, the original two surfaces, right? So there's your inner, There's your original small horizon, your original big horizon. They were both stable. They continue being stable for their existence. And I guess as I said, for the smaller one, we kind of lose track of it, but they continue being there for their existence. At the point where it was annihilated, if you think about it turning around in time, what happened is it picked up a negative eigenvalue. Or the other way you might want to think about is that original stable surface was annihilated by an unstable surface that came out. But there's only three stable surfaces here. There's the original black holes, original black hole horizons, and the outer horizon. Everything else is, to one degree or another, unstable. Many of them are unstable. We shouldn't say massively unstable. They have a lot of negative eigenvalues. But so in some sense, there's only three of them that are really important, right? The apparent horizons, the ones that you would think of as the apparent horizons. But they still have to interact with the rest of these guys. So the two original apparent horizons, we didn't actually see this, but we have evidence that happens, but certainly for the larger one, it gets destroyed by one of these unstable ones coming out and annihilating it. Kind of in the way that people thought about with the pair of pants diagrams, except of course it's way more complicated as this evolves. And then if you think about this guy, so this is zero negative eigenvalues, one, when it turns around again, that's two. I guess this is a really complicated one. That's one, two, three, and each turnaround point, you get an extra negative eigenvalue. So Daniel used this as a tool when he's looking at these things for, if you lose track of a horizon, then at the point when the eigenvalue, you get an eigenvalue vanishing, because that's what will happen is you pick up an extra negative eigenvalue. He knew then that in that case, he should start looking for another surface coming in to meet it. Whereas for these ones where he kind of lose track here, for numerical reasons, the spectrum of the eigenvalues is nothing is crazy happening, but you're just getting close to the punctures. So what happens? So then the picture you have is that even though there's many merging out trapped surfaces inside a black hole interior, only two of them are stable, which were the original ones, and everything else is unstable. And when I talked about the inner apparent horizon, you know, that was the one where the one that's been known for, you know, decades, that in fact, we kind of used to think of that as an apparent horizon as well, because that was really the only one we really knew about. But in fact, that was the representative of this larger class of unstable ones. And in fact, because it's unstable, we know it doesn't form a boundary between trapped and untrapped regions, right? So the nice picture that you have in Schwarzschild and spherical symmetry, where you have the trapped and the untrapped regions, that doesn't really work anymore in this more complicated situation, because you can't just clearly say, you know, this is the trapped region. You have trapped surfaces that go into the regions that you might have thought were untrapped, right? They will intersect. These aren't clear boundaries anymore. Unstable ones aren't boundaries between trapped and untrapped regions, I should have said. Okay, so I guess from that, so you have this rich dynamics inside. All of the MOTs except the outer and initial parent horizons are unstable. But as I said before, they do this play this role during the merger. So I got to my, I'm at the end here now. So what do you want to take away from this? Is merging outer trap surfaces are much more common than you likely thought. So it's not just R equals 2M in Schwarzschild. There's a lot more. They weren't seen, all these ones weren't seen because the traditional MOTS finders were basically set up not to be able to find them. I mean, it was a reasonable thing, but they couldn't see them. There was just no way they could find them. Even if there weren't numerical problems, they were functionally unable to find them. But these merging outer trap surfaces, they form an important role in black hole mergers and the axisymmetry we've seen them. We expect it will extend outside of axisymmetry, but we haven't seen that yet. But apparent horizons are much rarer than MOTS, but they are distinguished by the stability operator, which tells you that these are the apparent horizons. What you think of as an apparent horizon, you intuitively think are stable. The other ones are unstable. And besides that, though, the stability operator tells you all kinds of things. It tells you about these self-intersections, tells you about when you can expect evolution. You know that evolutions will continue, and it also tells you about the number of, as these things turn around in time and all kinds of things. So if you're looking for to understand what's happening inside a black hole merger with these horizons, the stability operator tells you all kinds of things, much more than we even thought before. And Daniel, if anyone was interested in using those axisymmetry codes, if you're doing it for an exact solution, you can just program it using Mapler Mathematica in seconds, right? But if you were interested in doing it for numerical codes, numerical data, then Daniel has them available on that GitHub. Okay, I think that's it. I'm done.
Okay, thank you very much, Ivan.
That's okay, thank you, Ivan.
Any additional questions?
Yeah, I've got one. So I can see how you do it in axisymmetry because you're looking for curves and then the whole surface is basically a surface of rotation. So how do you think of extending this beyond axisymmetry?
Yeah, so I mean, I guess in principle, one could, again, start out with a point and a surface, right? And then evolve them and then hope it will close up. But that seems like it would be, a much harder job. So what Daniel is doing is he's extending the horizon finder that he had, the one where you take a reference surface, and he's extending that to non-axisymmetry. I think he has it partially working already, I think. But then he has some other techniques. So once you understand this stuff is happening, there's other things. Like he looks at like surfaces with non-vanishing expansion and families of them as they start to approach vanishing ones, or now that he knows the kind of things to look for, those initial guesses, they don't need to be perfect, right? They can be, you could say, well, maybe there's going to be one that's going to circle and then you could look for it. So there's still going to be a bunch of guesswork in there to identify these. But the hope is, I guess, that once you know the kind of things that might happen, then you'll be more likely to be able to find them. I guess that's the,
okay. Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it's by no means a trivial extension there, I don't think.
Yeah, I can see that.
I mean, so the one question you could ask is you might think, well, what's going to happen here? Like, because you can imagine it's going to be much harder. You might think it might be much harder to find closed surfaces in 3D, in full away from symmetry. But on the other hand, there'd be lots more of them. So it's conceivable that this could just be a property of symmetry. We don't think so, but it's conceivable that depends how, the number of extra surfaces versus how hard to close, how it balances out, right? And we think the number of extra surfaces is going to win, but, it's possible it might not.
So Ivan, hi, thanks for the talk. I'm curious as to, well, even as one thinks of maybe going to 3D, perhaps before I would ask the question, given your experience, what can you do with this? I mean, do you envision perhaps if someone hands you a space time and don't tell you where it came from nor what it is, perhaps just looking at the collection of all the mods that you can find, will let you characterize the space time or something like that. I'm just trying to So what else can you do, what you can get out of more full knowledge of mods in a given space time?
Well, I think that's a good question, right? I mean, this is one of the questions I had at the beginning, but I'm not sure that I have an answer to it. I guess what it does tell you is it tells you something about the internal dynamics of the black hole, that you know you can find these surfaces or the internal geometry. This, of course, isn't observable, right? I mean, so because you're inside everything. So I don't know. That's a good question, Lisa. I mean, it's surprising these things exist. What information you could extract beyond the curiosity of, you know, looking at that picture in Hawking and Ellis or the Lesueux lectures from 1970 and wondering what happens next, is not so clear. I mean, there are these future holographic screens that people do things with, right? Or sometimes the other holography where they're shooting a minimal surface from infinity. It's conceivable they might have something to do with it, but I mean, we don't have anything on that at the moment.
Well, there might be something. So if you're looking for all the MOTS, then of course the number of is infinite, but they're all unstable. So maybe there's something about the number of stable MOTS in a given space-time. Maybe there's a characterization there that could be, you know, could be useful.
Yeah, I guess the only difficulty was that if it's not, you'd never know whether you found all of them. That's the hard bit, right? If you did know them all, though.
Of course.
It is quite dramatic that, because, you know, when we first did this, we were finding more and more of these and we were like shaking our heads and, you know, laughing kind of uncomfortably. And Badri was kind of uncomfortable that we had, you know, like maybe it looks like you can do nothing with these MOTS at all, right? But I guess the point is you have this huge plethora of them, but then when you start looking, you know, the stability operator in fact says, you know, there's a lot more order to there than you think, right? The stability operator tells you about how they interact. It tells you about which ones you could think of as black hole horizons or apparent horizons. So there is this order underlying them, right? Which we didn't realize at first. But like, you know, I think during that merger, I think it's unlikely that this melee in there, this craziness, I think it's unlikely that's going to correlate with anything in the gravitational wave signal, for example.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess it's also interesting about the terminology used here. I guess, for example, this light ring of Schwarzschild, people usually say it's unstable because you deviate from it, right? So the Lyapunov exponent is positive, but in your terminology, that would be stable. So,
I think this term, so I mean, the terminology we're using is taken from the Anderson-Mara-Simon, which again, in turn, is taken from differential geometry, right? So we are using kind of the standard names that you use there. But yeah, it is a strange, I mean, you know, of course, that terminology is a word anyway, because for example, minimal surfaces aren't necessarily minimal area, right? So there's a lot of kind of uncomfortable things about that terminology, but that is the that is the one that exists and came from the math literature.
Yeah, that's a good point, because I mean, when you were showing a picture about, you know, the Riemannian surface, I mean, I was thinking you're using the term backwards. I mean, the implication seemed to be completely counter what I expected. But yeah, I mean, the problem with words is that they carry meaning, and then, you know, it's not obvious to, I mean, if the meaning is opposite in a different context, it's not clear to me that the best choice of terminology was made. But, you know, you'll never win that fight, right? I mean,
I guess the paper, it connects. I mean, we thought about these kinds of things, right? But, you know, switching the name at that stage, that means then we don't actually match up with, you know, all these results from Anderson, Mara, Simon, all the mathematical people, right? And that seems like adds more confusion. But yeah, I think the minimal surface stuff probably goes back, I don't know, 150 years, maybe 200 years. I don't know how far it goes back, right? It's a, I agree though. The terminology and what stable and unstable means. Yeah, and in particular, like you said, Eric, unstable or stable sort of corresponds to the nearby ones being repelled.
Right.
And unstable means they orbit. But yeah, I guess unstable means that you can deform it smaller for minimal surfaces, and stable means you can't. But yes, but somehow then if you look at the nearby curves, then it's the complete opposite. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, so it's a communication point. It's probably good to tell people that, you know, it doesn't mean what you think it means.
That's a good point, yeah. We're kind of used to it now, so.
Okay, any more questions?
No, I'm really fascinated by this, and I heard your talk at the APS meeting, and I was, you know, you covered all of this in 12 minutes.
That's right.
I just couldn't, you know, parse anything out, so I'm really glad you gave this talk today.
Yeah, and the APS, yeah, I practiced that one a lot of times to try to get it in, but yeah, it was still pretty hard going, I guess, in 12 minutes, but... Okay. I would I recorded it several times because I'd get down and be like, oh no, I missed by 30 seconds. Okay. I'm going to try to do this without talking even faster, but the really neat thing about this is that really it could have been done in almost any time. Well, not the merger stuff, because of course, the mergers have only been understood for, you know, 15 years or whatever now, but the other stuff with Schwarzschild and Berlink would say it could have been done any time in the last 50 years, but somehow no one looked, right? And so it was a pretty fun thing to work on, because like I said, the methods are extremely simple to use, and we stumbled on them, and then you just generate, we'd have, you know, have our meetings, people would have all kinds of new stuff all the time, right? It was kind of a fun thing to do as well.
Yeah, no, it is. It's pretty neat.
Okay. No more questions. Let's thank Yvonne again for the very nice talk.